Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay. Hello. That's probably too loud again, isn't it? I'll go, just
yeah,
for the
just
first
get a bit,
bit
yeah,
I'll
exactly.
Just
like as if you just come in. You're just walking in. This is the bit you sort of say as you're coming onto the stage.
I should just go like, oh, hello. Didn't see you come in. This is the World Cricket Show. Wouldn't really fit with the theme music, though, would it? Right.
We're sorry. The number you have dialed is not in service at this time.
Hello, and welcome to the World Cricket Show, the world's favourite cricket show. My name is Adam Bayfield, and I take full responsibility for everything that follows tonight. And the young kid opposite me, who merely finds himself in the wrong place at the wrong time, is Tony Kerr.
Hey.
How you doing this week, Tone?
Yeah, very good.
You ready for this? You pumped up and ready to go?
Yeah.
Bit of cricket to talk about tonight, isn't there?
We're going to do this podcast the right way, though. In the spirit of podcasting.
Right, yeah.
We're not going to go overboard.
We've been chatting with our leadership group, and they've given us some pretty clear instructions, so we'll see if we can follow them through. Have we got our head of integrity present?
Yeah, we need one. If we had a leader, you hope we'd both be in the leadership group. If there is a leadership group and we're not part of it, something's gone horribly wrong with this podcast.
Yeah, I'd be very disappointed to not be part of a leadership group for a project that involves two people.
We'd be like the sort of, well, we'll come on to it. We'll make all kinds of satirical jokes, I'm sure. But anyway, carry on with your intro.
well, my intro, it just says here, satirical jokes. So
tick that box.
We have ticked that box. I mean, should we just get straight into it?
Yeah,
so
I think so.
We've got loads of cricket.
We're on a tight schedule.
We are on a tight schedule just because we've got so much to discuss, because we'll be talking about England's defeat in New Zealand. We'll be talking about the World Cup qualifier in Zimbabwe. But let's start, of course, in South Africa, where one of the biggest cricketing stories for a very long time has blown up over the last few days. Ball tampering. That's what it's all about, isn't it? I'm sure people don't really need me to go through this story, but I am aware that this is actually true. I'm aware that there are some people listening who listen to the World Cricket Show who don't get their cricket news from anywhere else. So I'll just round it up quickly.
Yeah, just run through it.
During Australia's test match against South Africa in Cape Town, television cameras got some footage of Cam Bancroft working on the cricket ball with what appeared to be something in his hand. When it became clear, once it had been picked up on TV and Darren Lehman, the coach, saw it on the screen in the dressing room, a message went out. The cameras again picked up Bancroft dropping whatever it was he had down his trousers. The umpires asked him what was going on. He claimed it was just his sunglasses case that he'd had in his hand. There was a press conference at the end of the day where Steve Smith sat with Cam Bancroft, and they admitted that they had been trying to change the condition of the ball, and it was a plant that they'd cooked up, that Smith and the rest of the leadership group had cooked up with Bancroft, and basically said, yeah, we did it, wasn't in the spirit of the game, there you go.
Let's all move on.
Yeah, well, that is what they said, wasn't it? Yeah, we'll learn from it and we'll move on. So in terms of the ramifications of that, the ICC have handed Steve Smith a one-match ban and fined him 100% of his match fee. Cam Bancroft, no ban, but 75% of his match fee. But Cricket Australia have just... You're going to tell me all about this press conference then, because I haven't seen it yet. But literally, as we went to air, James Sutherland was giving a press conference, and they've been sent home, haven't they? Is it Smith, Warner and Bancroft have all been sent home?
Our budget didn't quite stretch to sending us to Johannesburg in time for that press conference, so unfortunately can't bring you the first hand,
the inside scoop.
Yeah, exactly, the first hand account of what went down. But yeah, that's basically it. They've been sent home. Darren Lehman has kept his job. He's not going anywhere. And James Sutherland said, I mean, this is all going to be out of date because there's going to be another announcement tomorrow. Sutherland said that Liam would see out his contract, a basically promise of an announcement of sanctions tomorrow. So you can edit in, or not, whichever you decide, what the sanctions were. But yeah, he was pretty stony-faced, as we said. And yeah, said that there would be significant sanctions levied. So yeah, we'll wait to see what that is. But you know, talk of sort of 1 year bans.
And just in terms of a story, like that's obviously the those are the punishments that have been handed down. But it's been an extraordinarily big story. Like I say, it really has blown up. It was the top story on BBC News the other day. And like, I don't know, I don't know about you, but I've had like loads of people asking me about it, like people at work. People who have absolutely no interest in cricket whatsoever are aware of this story, following this story, asking about this story. I had to explain to someone what reverse swing was, which was complicated. So yeah, it's been huge. So I'm not sure where to start with this, really, Tone. We're going to try and make some sense of it tonight. But can you just give me an initial sense of what your hot take is on this whole thing? What were your thoughts when you first saw the footage and when you first saw the press conference and your first thoughts on everything?
This is like a sort of like 50 years later, we're looking back on it already. I mean, it
does feel like, yeah.
Yeah, a lot's happened.
It's been a long few days.
As you say, yeah, I mean, I can't remember a bigger cricket story, news story. I suppose the Stokes thing was pretty big, wasn't it? But this is slightly different. You know, it has been huge. And obviously, you know, you got a sense of that from just hearing, you know, I hadn't seen the footage when I heard about what had happened, but you sort of obviously immediately got a sense that this was going to be a massive story. Then I think the thing that really struck home was that first press conference with Smith and Bancroft, just the way they talked about what happened. And obviously it's the ball tampering is such a specific thing to cricket, isn't it? Oh, well, I suppose there are, you know, there might be some sort of similar thing in baseball, but in cricket, it's such a sacred thing, the ball, and tampering with it is such a specific no-no. And obviously, there's been a catalogue of these kind of things over the years, but this is definitely the most kind of blatant and just stupid one I've seen for a while. And the fact that it involves the current best Test batsman in the world. And someone as divisive as well as David Warner. Yeah, it's got all the ingredients.
Do you mean stupid because you sort of think, well, how did they think they were going to get away with it?
Exactly, yeah. And then and just, you know, the goofiness of it, of him sort of saying, like, oh, you know, we found out that the cameras had picked something up, so I shoved it down my trousers. It's like, it's slapstick nonsense, isn't it? Yeah, okay, if you want my sort of hot take on... Well, I mean, there's so many hot takes, aren't there? You could have. I mean, do you want the hot take on what it means, or the hot take on why it's been so interesting to people?
Well, you've got that little notebook there that says hot takes on the front. Yeah, Tony's hot takes.
Through.
So I'm interested in all of them, to be honest.
I think the reaction as a whole has been quite interesting, and the amount of interest it's generated. Yeah, you know, I've seen a couple of articles today. The Guardian's Barney Roney was saying, well, if one thing, at least it shows that people still care about cricket, which I don't know. I could take the point, but I'm not sure that's the sort of how relevant that is at the moment. Because, like, you know, a lot of people cared about, you know, Bradley Wiggins and doping and Team Sky, but how many people actually watch cycling day to day in the country? You know, Dan Rowan's very interested in it, but...
People like scandal, don't they?
Exactly, yeah. It's more that, yeah, exactly that. You know, I think possibly at this stage, obviously the thing's really built over the last few days, but maybe going slightly over the top now, the sort of level of scrutiny about it. I mean, I can see why, but...
Well, so that's my question. So when we very briefly talked about this the other day, we do our best not to talk about cricket away from the podcast, so we don't, you know, use up all the gold not on air. But we did very briefly talk about it the other day, and I got the sense that we were going to disagree somewhat about it, because you did seem quite upset. Well, upset's probably the wrong word. You did
seem in tears,
like, you did seem like you were sharing the outrage very much.
Yeah, somewhat. And, you know, I understand from the Australian side of things, you know, the reaction has very much been... Yeah, outrage, disgust, shame. You know, the Prime Minister of Australia has been out and about every day since it happened, saying something to that effect. You know, obviously their media yeah, the ex-players, the ex-Australian players who've sort of come out and said that, you know, this Australian team and particularly the guys involved at the top, you know, have sort of trashed the reputation of the baggy green in Australia. And then from, you know, from a British, well, from an English side, you can kind of see why why English cricket fans would be so ready to get on board with this, you know, for obvious reasons. So, you know, I'm not saying that's invalid, but in the grand scheme of things, it wasn't like an outrageous match fix. But still, yeah, but still obviously, you know, way outside of what you'd expect, the behavior you'd expect.
Yeah, okay, so it sounds like we're maybe not going to disagree as much as I thought. Like, so I've got a lot to say about this, and it's been a job to kind of, you know, to try and sort out my feelings, because it is a bit of a muddle, and I think a lot of different things at the same time. But on the one hand, I totally understand where this extreme reaction of anger and disgust, particularly in Australia, is coming from. I completely get it, because what they did was cheating, and it's not just cheating, it's incredibly brazen cheating. And it was the press conference, really, was the thing. Like, if Smith and Bancroft had gone to ground and said nothing about it, we probably wouldn't be talking about it, or we'd have come onto it probably 40 minutes through the show tonight. We'd be talking about 58 all out right now. But the press conference was jaw-dropping, really, wasn't it? And it was the fact that they were just so openly like, yeah, you know, we thought we could get an advantage, so we decided to do it. They made a collective decision to cheat. They knew what they were doing, and they didn't appear to show all that much remorse about it. I mean, there was sort of a surface level of remorse, but it, you know, in what Steve Smith was saying, it did seem very much like they were mainly upset because they'd got caught. I think they thought that if they just like fronted up, people would respect them for it and be much more willing to forgive. And this is a thing that I think you see in sort of wider life quite a lot now as well, where, you know, if people make some catastrophic mistake, they just go, well, you know, I take full responsibility, I'll hold my hands up. And I think people think if they just own up to it, that that's all they really need to do, or like people will move on. Like, you can see where that's coming from. In a sense, it's like refreshing, or it is the right thing to do to own up to a mistake. But in this case, I think it's made the situation much worse, because it's had the opposite effect. Where they've been so transparent about what they were doing, people have seen that they came to a decision to do it. You know, instead of getting more respect, people have lost a lot of respect for them. And it particularly doesn't work when you say things so kind of half-hearted, as Smith said, and also when you say things like, well, we'll just, you know, we'll learn from it and we'll move on. Well, you don't get to decide when we move on. So yeah, Smith came out of that press conference a seriously diminished figure, didn't he? And it seemed like he didn't really understand the implications of what he was saying, or the gravity of what he was saying. And there was lots of things about it that were pathetic, really, like the fact that he got Bancroft to take the first question. You know, on the one hand, it sort of seemed like Smith was, as I say, was fronting up and facing the music, but then he got Bancroft to take the first question. And like, what was, if it was the case that Smith had cooked up this plan with the leadership group, why what were they doing getting Bancroft to do the dirty work for them? I mean, so, you know, you lost a lot of respect for him in various different ways. And I thought Michael Vaughan made a good point. I mean, Vaughan said a lot of things about this, but he did one good point that he made on Tuffers and Vaughan yesterday, was saying Smith was sort of paying lip service to apologising, or he was apologising to like the Australian public and the cricketing public more widely. But there's no apology in there to South Africa, like to the South African team. You know, you'd think that would be the first thing they would do. It was almost like they didn't understand that they weren't just sort of cheating the Australian public, or breaking the, you know, or trespassing on the spirit of the game. They were actually cheating their opponents. So, sorry, I've spoken quite a lot here, Tony, so do jump in.
No, I'm just letting you keep going.
Yeah.
Just checking my emails now.
One of the quotes from Smith was, that's not the kind of cricket we want to play. You know, yeah, we did it. It's against the spirit of the game. It's not the kind of cricket we want to play. Well, don't f-ing do it then, Steve. Like, it's not hard. If that's not the kind of cricket you want to play, don't do it. And there was another weird quote from Bancroft, which I've alluded to already, where he said, yeah, I just sort of found myself in the wrong place at the wrong time. It's just like, yeah, I think there may be a bit more to it than that. So yes, for all those different reasons, it's an outrageous thing to do, and I totally understand why there's been anger about it. But at the same time, I do think there's been something of an overreaction. You know, that, as you say, it's become this kind of national crisis in Australia with the Prime Minister getting involved. I mean, beggars belief that they would do this, which
I knew that was coming.
It sort of does, but yeah, and they can, people in Australia can react however they want. They're entitled to react however they want, and it's probably good that they're overreacting in this way rather than, you know, underreacting, I suppose, to cheating. It's good that people are so passionately anti-cheating in Australia, and clearly this sets a terrible example, not just in cricket, but in all walks of life. But I just think the scale of the outrage is pretty disproportionate. You know, people out there calling for lifetime bans, people equating it with match fixing, with spot fixing, with doping. It's not in the same ballpark as those things. Other cricketers have done this, not least Faf du Plessis, the opposition captain, who was found guilty of it a year ago and previously in 2013 as well, when he was rubbing the ball on his zip. Mike Atherton in 1994, various Pakistan players over the years. You know, there's lots of examples. They're not the first cricketers to do this. All right, yeah, it was with possibly a bit of sandpaper or something, which is more than just rubbing it on the zip. But, you know, they're not breaking new ground here.
You know, using whatever natural resource you can, that you have available to you, is just... that's part of the game, isn't it? To get as much out of the ball as possible. I mean, some people have already said, well, shouldn't you just let any kind of tampering go on? You know, legalize ball tampering, which is just a sort of nonsense to me, because then you may as well just start with you kind of, people take you on, you know, blocks of like pumice stone or something throughout the ball. You may as well just start with a half and half, like tape tennis ball. But, you know, for as long as cricket has been going on, I presume, I don't know who first came up with the idea of, you know, polishing one side of the ball.
I thought you were going to say of cricket.
But
it's going to be a long podcast if we're getting into that.
But, you know, that's part of the game is trying to make the ball work in your favour. Now, obviously, taking or using something, a foreign object, it probably takes things a little bit too far and is rightly outlawed and, rightly... anyone doing that should receive some sort of punishment. Yeah, I think, but I agree with you that to a certain extent, the reaction has been now blown out of proportion somewhat. I mean, I suppose the fact though that it's the captain, you know, that doesn't look good. And as you said before, though, the way it came out, the admission in the press conference, I think that's had a real key part to play in it, because it's kind of, it's sort of undermined the whole concept of the Australian dressing room. I don't know, like, and the leadership of Smith, the leadership of the coach, and as many people have said, on top of a lot of different incidents and behaviours over the last couple of years, you know, people have been quite ready to sit the boot in, I think.
Yeah, it's the fact that they obviously had this very calm discussion, you know, sort of cold-blooded discussion about the fact that they were going to cheat. You know, should we cheat? Yeah, let's cheat. I mean, that's what's been so astounding, isn't it? But I don't know, though, because I people are kidding themselves if they think that in previous cases something similar didn't happen. I think the only difference here really is that they've admitted it, which, as I say, I think they thought would get them off the hook in a sense, but has actually made things much worse. But it's not like, you know, I've seen people compare it to diving in football, which I don't think it is directly comparable, because, yeah, okay, some players do think to themselves, as soon as I get an opportunity, I'm going to go down in the box, whatever. But you need that opportunity to arise, don't you? It's going to be a heat of the moment decision to go down or not to go down. Whereas this was like, yeah, we're going to take an object out onto the pitch with us. It's not quite the same in terms of the decision making process, but is anything different there when it comes to Faf du Plessis rubbing the ball on his zip? I mean, he's still making that decision to do it, isn't he? And I don't think you can compare that to diving either. I think he's sort of quite rationally deciding that this is what he's going to do to get an advantage. And no one really cares about the fact that Faf du Plessis did that in 2013. I agree with you, though, that taking a foreign object out onto the pitch with you is a step further. And yeah, there's another weird quote that Bancroft had in the press conference where he said, you know, Well, I just saw an opportunity to use a bit of type to... It's like, what do you mean you saw an opportunity? Like, there was an opportunity there for me to go to the dressing room and dig around to find some tape.
Like, players do have their hands taped up, don't they? So
I suppose
maybe they thought they would get away with it, you know, on that basis, that tape isn't the most foreign object that you might find on a cricket field. But it's still... It wasn't attached to his hand. It was
loose. I think, to be fair to Bancroft, you know, people do say things when they're under pressure like that, when he must have been panicking. We should probably cut him a little bit of slack in terms of what he's saying. As we know, Tone, if someone puts a microphone in front of you, you just start talking.
You just blurt stuff out. I mean, it's certainly one thing that's something, you know, common strand of the discussion, certainly in the last 24 hours, has been David Warner and his role in it, and also just his standing in the Australian dressing room. You know, supposedly he's a sort of pariah, and he's been completely shut out of the group. He's left the WhatsApp group of his own accord, and he's keeping himself away from everyone else.
David Warner has left the conversation.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, that's interesting. I've seen a lot of people talking about Warner and the kind of person he's been. And
well, there seems to be a narrative has emerged today, we're recording this on Tuesday, that it was actually Warner who was the architect of the plan. It was basically Warner and Bancroft who came up with the idea between them, or Warner came up with the idea and he enlisted Bancroft. And Smith, if he knew about it, it wasn't his idea, but Smith in that press conference was basically trying to protect Warner by saying, yeah, I knew about it, and it was the leadership group, because there's a lot of stories coming out that, you know, because people said, oh, who's the leadership group? And supposedly it's Lyon and Stark and Hazelwood, and they're apparently furious and, you know, feel that they're being thrown under the bus. So yes, people now saying that it really was Warner who was at the heart of the whole thing. But just to come back to why I think the reaction is quite out of proportion at this point, because I'm not sure I quite explain why. Like, the fact that people have done it in the past isn't enough in itself to be like, well, that's fine then. I mean, it's not fine, but, you know, it's not an excuse, the fact that people have done it in the past. But you saying about, you know, you've seen people say, well, ball tampering should be legalized, and, well, you may as well then take a pumice stone out on the field. I totally get what you're saying, and it is that's a very difficult thing. Like, you can't just legalize ball tampering because, yeah, then people will be taking out, like, pen knives and drills and things.
Yeah, and exactly. And the end game of ball tampering is to create a ball with a smooth side and a rough side, so you may as well just start with that, because that's what, you know, people are just going to be between every ball rubbing the ball on the ground. I don't know, there's no...
Yeah, but this is the point, because between every ball, you know, in cricket as it currently exists, between every ball, the players are ball tampering. They're shining the ball on their trousers, the old spit and polish. Like, what is that if not ball tampering? It's just because it's happened forever, it's sanctioned and it's part of the game, isn't it? It's a very, very early memory of playing cricket for the first time was being taught how to shine the cricket ball. It's like a tradition almost within cricket, but it is ball tampering. It's nothing else but ball tampering. It's changing the condition of the ball to produce a better outcome for the bowlers. And if that is, you know, not only fine, but positively encouraged, I don't really get why doing similar things to try and rough up the ball is so heinous. Like, I agree that it's very difficult to draw the line, but this is why I don't think you can possibly equate this to match fixing or doping, because while it's cheating, the actual act itself is not some kind of moral scandal. You know, it's cheating because they're gaining an advantage, but it's not like match fixing, which is, you know, is like immoral. This is a very difficult area in cricket, and I think although you can't legalise ball tampering, I think there's a case to allow a lot more of that kind of thing than is currently allowed. A, as I say, the spit and polish is perfectly acceptable, and B, what they're trying to do is get the ball to reverse swing, and reverse swing is great. Cricket is much better when the ball reverse swings. Some of the most memorable moments in Test cricket over the last 20-25 years are when the ball's reverse swinging around. You know, the Pakistan bowlers in the 90s, Waqar and Wasim, getting the ball to reverse swing, like, that's phenomenal to watch. England in 2005 won the Ashes with the reverse swing, and we loved that. So if we were to say, let's make it so that it's easier for bowlers to get reverse swing, would that make cricket better or worse? I think there's a pretty obvious answer to that. So while, yes, you like, so in this particular case, when they're rubbing it with sandpaper or whatever, that can't be allowed, because where do you draw the line? But I think there is a case to have a lot more of it, and therefore what they're doing is not the same as being paid off by a bookmaker to throw the game, basically. It's
yeah. I think that's a really interesting perspective. I mean, I guess it depends whether you see the polishing of the ball as you know, preserving, or you know, the sort of the legal aspect is preserving the condition of the ball to the best of your ability, whilst the other half or whilst the other side degrades, mm-hmm. or is the work you're doing to the shiny side of the ball as much of a sort of positive impact, or having as much impact on the ball itself as degrading the side yeah. manually
is it,
that you're trying to rough up? Do you know what I mean?
Making it unnaturally
exactly
shiny. Well, it is, isn't it? Certainly when it's very new.
It starts very shiny, doesn't it? So really, you're allowed to preserve one side mm-hmm. as the other side. Now, I guess, you know, if you did have some sort of legal ball tampering, it would you know, you'd... Well, as you say, there is ball tampering as it is, but if you were to legalize or you were to extend the possibilities of ball tampering, it would open up this sort of dark art. Teams would be trying to find ways to do it to their own, you know, with the balls they're bowling to get an advantage that other teams perhaps don't have. So I don't know, it's a difficult one. I don't think, you know, your reverse swing utopia is ever going to be, is ever going to come into being. But
well, that may well be so, but it's not like Australia were doing this because they just wanted the fans to have better cricket to watch. You know, they were doing it to win the game. But all I mean is, like, so and I'm aware that people will be, you know, screaming on the bus listening to this, or, you know, composing tweets at me at the moment. I'm not condoning it, and I'm not saying that because they're just trying to get reverse swing that somehow makes it fine. Like, the fact is that at the moment it is illegal. So if one team does it and the other doesn't, then the team that does it is going to have an advantage that the other team who's playing by the rules doesn't. So it's not fair. Like, if you think that ball tampering should be allowed, then you need to make that case. You shouldn't just do it. As I say, as I explained at length, like, I think this is outrageous what they did. It's really pissed me off, actually, like, that cricket is in the news because of this. And as I say, loads of people at work are asking me about, the cricketers who are cheating. Like, it's very annoying, and it's annoyed me a lot as a neutral fan. And like, if this had happened in a test match against England, you know, with the Ashes on the line, I'd be spitting. I'd probably be on a plane out there so I could give Steve Smith a piece of my mind. So I really hate cheating. Like, if I come up against cheating in a sport that I'm playing, like, I think you were there, Tony, when I got really annoyed when we were playing football the other day by someone where I was trying to go past them down the wing and I kicked it onto their knee and it went out for a throw-in, and the referee gave the throw-in to the other team, and the guy that I'd kicked it against just went to get the ball and take the throw-in, and I was like, you know that hit you. Like, not even, like, brushed you. It just bounced off your knee and went out for a throw. And he was like, play to the whistle, mate. Like,
yeah.
That, like, even something like that, which a lot of people would say, well, you should play to the whistle, that really, really pisses me off. So I hate cheating and I hate what they've done here. But my only point is that the thing itself that they were doing is not some great moral disgrace. As I say, it's not equivalent to match fixing. It's not equivalent to doping. And I just think people are maybe getting a bit too carried away. Firstly, because, you know, for English pundits and fans, it's fun to pile in on the Australians. There is definitely an element of glee in some of the reaction to it in England. And for everyone around the world, and for the Australians themselves, a lot of people really don't like Steve Smith and David Warner, and with justification to a large extent. But we're supposed to believe in equality before the law. And I don't know, if it was Faf du Plessis again, I don't think people would be going in on him in the same way.
Yeah, no, exactly. The people involved and their recent history has obviously got a big part to do with why it's blown up in the way it has. I mean, and the fact that Smith has been so dominant in recent times. Yeah, I mean, who knows kind of where or what, how we'll look back on it in a few years. I mean, you've got to think Steve Smith can come back from this. But I mean, yeah. Bancroft hasn't, I don't know, he's in a difficult situation because
he hasn't scored any runs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's not made any mark in a short career. But yeah, as for Warner, that just the groundswell of opinion against him, would suggest that probably he will be sort of, I don't know, if not already, has been hung up to dry on this one.
Well, I've seen people saying that, oh, you know, Steve Smith will never live this down, and like whatever else he achieves in his career, there'll always be this asterisk against him. I mean, I think it'll always be part of the story, but
I'd be that's surprised. That's over-egging the bacon or whatever the expression is.
Yeah. It's like Atherton with the soil in the pocket. Like, yeah, people do bring it up occasionally. It's not been totally forgotten, but it's not the first thing you think of when you think of Michael Atherton, is it? And Steve Smith's going to end up with a batting average about 30 runs higher than Michael Atherton. So does this cast a cloud over the ashes, do you think, Sainio? Does it make you suspect that they might have done it on other occasions, including in the Ashes series? A few people, again, Michael Vaughan has been saying a lot.
Broad said similar, or maybe didn't go quite that far.
Yeah,
but
he kind
certainly
of alluded to it, didn't he?
I mean, I wouldn't like to say definitely. Obviously, I couldn't say definitely. You know, I don't doubt it either. I mean, it's entirely possible. You know, certainly them sort of saying that they'd spotted this opportunity then and there, and it just so happened that was the time they deployed it. I mean, there is a sense of a, you know, and a lot of people are saying it, of a cover-up. I don't know. There's a lot of conspiracy theories, but, you know, certainly the way it's been handled, the fact that Lehman's been just, you know, exonerated so far, won't resign, hasn't been sacked, you know, I think he should probably have resigned. If I was him, I'd have resigned, because I don't think you can kind of oversee that and all the other stuff that's gone on with the team. You know, lots of observers are crying out for this to be a line in the sand, and that the Australian team culture needs to change. And, you know, and he's been obviously, well, he's at the focal point of that. So, I'm surprised he hasn't gone, as most people are, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, as you say, it's the fact that it came after a week in which people were questioning his position anyway, because of the things that he was saying, you know, or the seeming hypocrisy with which he was saying crowds shouldn't abuse Australian players. And, you know, obviously people pointing out that he'd encourage Australian fans to send Stuart Broad home in tears and that kind of thing. And the more general thing, as I say, people don't like this Australian team for lots of very good reasons. And Lehman's overseen that, or even fostered that culture, hasn't he? So yeah, there's other reasons why he should stand down as well. And I agree, if he's overseen this, or at the very least, you know, he was either negligent or a part of it. But, you know, although I'm not quite convinced by the people saying, well, he must have known, like there's no way he couldn't have known. I mean, it's perfectly plausible to me that he didn't know, if indeed it was like Warner's idea and he spoke to Bancroft and then Smith kind of found out on the field of play, which seems to be kind of where it's going. And yes, there was the shot of Lehman on the walkie-talkie to Peter Hanscom, the 12th man, and him going, and people said, well, he clearly knew because he's on the walkie-talkie, but he may well have just seen it on the TV and gone, bloody hell, what are they doing?
Yeah.
So that's really plausible to
me.
So he may well not have known, but nonetheless, he should probably step down for all those other reasons, and because the fact that this Australian team is so disliked. And ultimately, you know, the buck's got to stop somewhere, doesn't it? And if the captain and vice-captain are sent home in disgrace, it doesn't reflect that well on the coach, does it?
Well, exactly. I was watching the press conference on Sky Sports News earlier on this evening, and there was a little wait. It was supposed to start at 6. I think it didn't get underway until about 20 past in the end. So there was a long period of discussion. They had Bob Willis in the studio. Jim White was the presenter. And if you've never watched Sky Sports News, if you're not from the UK, Jim White is a Scottish TV presenter, infamous in sporting circles for his presentation of Deadline Day, the football transfer Deadline Day coverage on Sky Sports News. And it sort of, you know, the way he sort of hams it all up and sometimes, you know, conjures something out of utter nothingness on Deadline Day. But it was funny that when they were talking about the potential the sanctions, and, you know, obviously Bob Willis doesn't mince his words, but I don't think Jim White was getting overexcited. Just some of the language used, he was, you know, saying to Bob Willis, should Lehman swing for it? Which I thought was somewhat harsh.
Yeah. Yes, can you see what I mean? I think there's been a little bit of an overreaction.
Yeah. To the chair. for the three of them, the four of them. Oh, the other thing that just the stark contrast between the press conference with Bancroft and Smith, you know, this time around, and the one during the Ashes when they were in hysterics about the Bairstow non-event headbutt, which at the time I can't remember who it was, but someone described it as that press conference will haunt England for generations to come, and as many other people have pointed out, just how quickly that was the first thing I thought about when I saw the most recent press conference, was just how quickly things have turned around for those two.
Yeah,
I mean, at the time, we were slightly ruffled by that because it was obviously such a stupid story out of nothing, and the way that the Australian team played on it was slightly irritating.
Well, it's one of the many reasons why people don't like this Australian team and don't like Steve Smith in particular. Like, he was very keen, seemingly, to make something out of that, as he has been with the Kikiza Rabada stuff in this series. I mean, Rabada's not blameless in that affair, but Smith was seemingly really trying to get him banned, and same with Bairstow, like really trying to create a controversy where it doesn't seem like there should have been one. Smith has been simultaneously trying to set himself up as a kind of moral guardian of the game and going out of his way to try and get other cricketers in trouble. So, yes, you can understand why there's quite a lot of schadenfreude about this and why people are so happy, not reluctant to get stuck into him. And yeah, people don't like Warner either for lots of good reasons. So I do totally understand it. But as I say, if the South Africans had been caught out doing this, or if the Sri Lankans had been caught out doing this, I don't think, I mean, people would say, well, they wouldn't do it, which maybe they wouldn't. But you know what I mean? Like, it just wouldn't. I don't think the scale of the hysteria would be quite the same. There was some poetic justice the next day with Australia losing the test match in pretty spectacular fashion, crumbling in a heap in what was a pretty spellbinding session of cricket. Mornay Morkel with a fiver, and they were bowled out for just over 100, wasn't it? They lost their all 10 wickets for 50. So South Africa won that game by 322 runs to take a 2-1 lead in the series. So it's going to be quite a tasty game, this fourth and final test, isn't it?
Fair to say. The atmosphere when the Australians went out to bat in their final innings in that test was pretty extraordinary. I mean, kind of what those guys must have been sort of thinking, or I haven't seen scenes like that in a cricket match for ever, I don't think.
And this is one of the weird things about it, isn't it? Because it's like everyone, including the two of us, are like so angry about it. And like I say, I'm angry that we're having to talk about it to people who don't really care about cricket. But at the same time, it's like must watch.
Well, that's
cricket
it. That's
now.
The flip side, isn't it? Yeah, it's they're going to be doing good business in that final. Yeah. So everyone's going
to
be watching it.
Like, people do like to talk about this kind of thing. It does. It is interesting and exciting, isn't it? And I think I text you that I can't stop reading about it. I'm obsessed with reading articles and tweets about it. And I wasn't, as we said on the last show, although I'd watched some highlights of the first two tests, I wasn't really that invested in this South Africa-Australia series, a bit of fatigue post-Ashes and stuff, whereas suddenly now I'm really into it. And so, maybe that's why Smith and Bancroft decided to do it. Like, just really...
just get you going.
Yeah, get some eyeballs on the game.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Well, leaving the ball tampering stuff behind, there's been another test match taking place in the Southern Hemisphere. Tone, England were involved playing New Zealand in Auckland. I don't want to spend too long on this, and not just because of the result, but because we've got a lot to get through tonight. So Kane Williamson won the toss and chose to bowl. And at the time, that seemed like quite a big call. But you'd have to say it paid off, as England were bowled out for 58 on the first afternoon. Only two bowlers used by New Zealand. Trent Bolt took 6 wickets. Tim Southey, 4 wickets. And actually, it could have been a lot worse for England. At one stage, it looked like they might be heading for a world record low score. And when they were 27 for 9, it was looking like they might be heading for an England record low score. But 33 not out from Craig Overton, you know, really put a score on the board with 58. Obviously, that was game over. Or so we thought, but then there was so much rain in Auckland, virtually 2 days lost to rain, that actually England did have a chance of saving the game, because New Zealand was still batting deep into the fourth day. They eventually declared on 427 for 8, hundreds for Kane Williamson and Henry Nicholls, not out on 145. So England had, what, about 4 sessions to survive. They were going okay, half centuries from Mark Stoneman and Joe Root, but Joe Root was out to the last ball of day 4, Trent Bolt with a brutal bouncer. And yeah, so they were 3 down. It seemed unlikely that they'd bat out the final day, and indeed they didn't. They were all out for 320, with 3 wickets for Bolt, 3 wickets for Todd Astall, and 3 wickets for a very fired up Neil Wagner, as New Zealand sealed the win by an innings and 49 runs. So, what did you make of this then, Tane? We made some fairly cautious and to some extent negative noises about England's prospects on our preview show, but you still had England down to win the series. It's not going swimmingly for that prediction so far, is it? And it's not going swimmingly for England. Yeah, that collapse on the first day, 58 all out, collapsing like Facebook's share price. Do you like that?
There's solid.
Some topical humour there for you, Tony. You never lose it.
Snap might have been a better one. Snapchat.
Is that
that's going as
share
well.
Price collapsing?
That's plunging. Yeah, did I have England as 1-0?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think yeah.
I had 1-1, which is still on.
Yeah, I thought when the rain came, I thought, you know, might be back England for a big turnaround in the second test. I mean, it doesn't look good, does it? I think I've defended England quite a lot over the last 12 to 18 months.
12 to 79 months.
Now, I'm not a flip-flopper. I'm not going to just launch in full with a full-blooded assault, but you know, it doesn't look good. You know, a lot of people were doubting the point of the series as a whole. Now you did want England to
by
finish
this guy,
yeah, exactly. You did want England to finish the tour. I mean, they've still got one more game to go, but to finish strongly and yeah, a pretty astonishing way to go in that first test. Yeah, I think yeah, you're now looking at significant changes for the summer.
It really was dreadful batting on that first day, wasn't it? I mean, it was magnificent bowling from Bolt, but some really desperate batsmanship as well. Bairstow getting caught and bowled, Moeen missing a full toss. I mean, it was not great viewing, really. I mean, were they undercooked? Was that the problem? Like, that, you know, only, what, 2, you know, pretty pointless warm-up games that were, what, like 14, 15 a side, you know,
mess around,
yeah,
basically.
Mucking
yeah.
about. Is that the problem?
I think they're probably a decent chunk of the problem. You know, obviously England didn't have a good go of it in the Ashes. Since then, you've had ODIs, T20s, players have come and gone, and you know it does rather undermine the whole exercise if you don't give them proper preparation. You know, there was a slight improvement, wasn't there, in the second innings. Root, you might think if Root had got through the day, that maybe England could have made a better fist of it on the on the final day, but you know, another slightly disappointing end for him. Yeah, Moeen Ali's possibly now looking like he's not going to enjoy his flight back because he may be back to county cricket.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. So as you say, you've got to think now that it's going to force some changes. So in a weird way, I'm actually quite pleased that it happened. Like, I mean, 58 all out is an unmitigated disaster.
And as you say, only saved by a bit of hitting from Overton. I mean, it could have been much worse.
It really could.
And then,
you
know, the heat has been slightly taken off England with what's happened with Australia. So
that's been massively taken off. Like, no one's talking about it.
Yeah.
But it's such a disaster that I don't think there's any hiding from it. There's no thought of taking the positives. So it might be, as you say, the thing that finally forces changes, that finally forces a bit of a shake-up of this team and of the thinking about England's Test cricket more generally. Like, the batting has been terrible for quite some time, not just in the Ashes, but for a number of years, there have been big problems in the batting. Going back to, certainly, the Ashes in 2015, you know, Gary Balance was missing full tosses and England were constantly 20 for 3. I mean, it's at least that long, if not longer. Now, this is quite a strong word, but it's embarrassing that Moeen Ali is still in the team. Like, after the Ashes that he had, to just rock up in Auckland and pick him again, no questions asked, is a scandal. And I know that I'm not Moeen's biggest fan, so I would say that. But it's extraordinary, really. He's averaging like 120 with the ball this winter. He should not be in the team. Doesn't mean that he can never come back, but you can't keep picking him. And I do just think this might be the thing that makes the difference. So I'm counterintuitively quite pleased that this has happened. Like, as I say, coming out of the Ashes, our big worry, even more than the poor performance, was that England didn't appear to appreciate just how poor a performance it was. We felt that they were deluded, and they're still deluded, or at least before this game, they were still deluded. So after this, surely they can't go on making the same selections. They've been making very conservative selections, sticking with people like Moeen, as I say, and in this game choosing Craig Overton over Mark Wood. You know, it's just time to be brave, isn't it? It's time to be much braver. They've got to pick Jack Leach. They've got to pick Mark Wood. I know people are saying, you know, Wood's just not fit enough to play Test cricket. You know, he can get through 10 overs in an ODI, but can he get through 15 a day in a Test match? Well, that might be true, but what's he doing in the squad then? Like, he's either fit enough or isn't. If they don't think he's fit enough to play Test cricket, he shouldn't be in the Test squad. But if they've taken him to New Zealand to play Test matches, play him in a Test match. I'm really pleased for New Zealand, though. I'm not sure they were given enough respect coming into this series, possibly because...
By us,
I think they were. But I mean, sort of generally, Michael Vaughan I'm really talking about. No, I'm not really talking about Michael Vaughan.
Really got it in for Vaughan tonight.
Well, actually, I listened to Tuffers and Vaughan. I've not got it in for Vaughan here, but I do have it in for Phil Tufnell, although not on this edition of Tuffers and Vaughan, but on the previous one. I think when they were previewing this Test series, I think Vaughan was saying that Mark Stoneman should be dropped, and Tufnell was like, oh, that seems a bit harsh, you know, after the Ashes, when he's had to stand up against that terrific Australian bowling attack. Now you're going to take him out and, you know, he's going to miss out on a few juicy little throwdowns. It's like, have you not watched New Zealand play cricket before? This is what I mean. I think they were massively underestimated by a lot of people. They're a really great side, aren't they? Great side
they
to
are.
Watch.
Yeah, fantastic. Nothing easy about Bolt and Southee. And, you know, England in that first innings didn't even get past them. So, yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I suppose the whole... You can't really necessarily blame people for underestimating New Zealand. The very fact that it's just the sort of the after event. I mean, I guess... I don't know what New Zealand's record is like in England recently. I can't remember.
Well, it's not outstanding by any means. Yeah. They got a draw there in 2015, but that's the first good result they've had for quite a while. But I mean, that, like, this was only the 10th time New Zealand have beaten England ever in Test cricket, which is pretty amazing, isn't it? Pretty amazing that the number's that small. But in the last 3 or 4 years, they've been one of the best Test sides in the world. And given England's struggles this winter and going over the last few years away from home, I was surprised that people were so confident that England were going to win here. I mean, yes, in a way they should win because they've got far more resources financially and in terms of population and everything else. But just looking at the two teams and their recent form, you know, I don't really know why England started as big favourites.
Yeah, okay. Well, they didn't, though, did they?
No, well, they started as favourites.
Yeah, I think I certainly expected it to be more even. I thought, you know, sort of you'd have hoped that England, you know, would have gone out with a real mentality to put something right after the Ashes. I don't know, there's still one game left. Let's not throw them under the bus just yet. But I mean, there is a tendency, and I'm guilty of it as well, that you sort of very quickly forget the failings of England national teams, cricket, rugby, football, and you sort of, on the eve of anything, you kind of resort to sort of the default kind of optimism and yeah, slight whiff of arrogance about it. I don't know. Maybe it's foolish to be hopeful for the second Test, but I mean, we talked about the day night element. On that first afternoon, England didn't even get to dusk.
Yeah, true.
So, yeah. You know, you can't make an excuse out of that.
That was no part of it, was it? And a lot of it was, I mean, to be fair, I'd say it was terrible batting, but it was brilliant bowling. And Trent Bolt is phenomenal, isn't he? And he's such a, like, with everything that's gone on this week, and we've talked about, you know, how everybody hates Smith and Warner in the Australian team, couldn't be more different, like just polar opposite the New Zealand team. And Trent Bolt in particular, his interview when he got the Man of the Match award, he's just a lovely man. He's a lovely, lovely man. I tweeted something about that, and a listener by the name of Martin Partridge responded that in New Zealand, his nickname is Lovely Trenty, which I don't think is true, but I hope it is. So he was brilliant. You know, Southie excellent on the first day as well. Neil Wagner is really great to watch. As I say, he was fired up. He's you've got to love his passion. And yeah, some great batting too. Henry Nicholls and another brilliant knock from Kane Williamson. So they're a really excellent team, New Zealand. I do feel like maybe people are underestimating them now because McCullum's not there anymore. And McCullum was very much the face of the team, wasn't he? And he was such a massive part of the team. He's not there, so maybe people think, you know, well, you know, you cut off the head and the body dies. But the rest of the team is still excellent. And he's been replaced by Williamson as captain, who's also a very good leader. So, you know, I just think they're a really good test side, and I wouldn't bet a lot of money on England winning this second game in Christchurch. Do you think there's any way back for them?
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't buy. Well, I would agree. I wouldn't put huge amounts of money on it. I mean, I still think, right, I agree with you. I take the point that, you know, some fairly wholesale changes are needed. A lot of people are talking about the record that now, or that's been extended with this defeat. What is it, 11 losses? No, sorry, 12 matches without a win, isn't it?
Away from home.
Yeah, away from home.
9 defeats in the last 10, 5 of them by an innings.
Yeah, which is not great.
No.
I will concede that. But, I mean, it's tough. I think, going to India, going to Australia, those were tough series. I don't think there's any shame in being defeated, although, you know, obviously the scale of the defeats were slightly troubling. There are circumstances around the preparation and the sort of the fact that this New Zealand series has come right at the end of a fairly arduous tour. Mm-hmm. England need a break, basically, in Test cricket.
No, there's mitigating factors, or you could look at it and say it's not quite as bad as it appears on the surface. But I'd be more forgiving, I think, if the noises coming out of the England camp were like, yeah, you know, we've got a lot of work to do.
Yeah,
we need to think about making changes.
Yeah.
But they, like, certainly coming out of the Ashes, the feeling from them was very much like, yeah, it wasn't really that bad. We could have won it. Things are actually pretty great. Yeah, you know, it after losing 4-0, that was pretty galling to hear. And yeah, I do hope that this will be a bit of a wake-up call, 58 all out. It's a funny one, isn't it? Because it's always the case that you change the bowlers when the batsmen self-destruct. But what do you do? I mean, there's just no batsman in the squad. Like, you could change the batting, but maybe bring in Liam Livingstone, and maybe they should bring in Liam Livingstone, but there's not a lot of options. It's not like, oh, if only we'd had James Vince in there, this wouldn't have happened. You can make changes to the bowling attack because there are options. There just aren't really options in the batting. And that, again, is what really concerns me, is less that, or it would be better if you thought, yes, the batting is bad, they need to get these guys out because there are people knocking on the door. There's no one knocking on the door, really. That's the bigger concern.
Yeah, there's a lot of head scratching going on.
I'm certainly scratching my head. Much like a piece of sandpaper down Cameron Bancroft's trousers, this episode of the World Cricket Show has touched some very sensitive areas, and we're now desperately hoping to get rid of it. Have you had fun tonight, Tony?
It's been all right, yeah. I've just got back from a few days away, so feeling...
On holiday, you might say.
Feeling slightly groggy still and a bit chubby and not thinking straight.
So where did you go?
Just France, the country of France.
Oh yeah, I've heard of it.
Potted about Paris, a bit of wine, a lot of wine.
You were saying to me that the person organising the trip, like, emailed everyone before with like a list of things not to forget to pack, and one of them was Rennie's.
No, that was literally the only item on the packing
list. Oh,
that
was the only item. Yeah. It's like indigestion tablets, right?
Yeah, everyone had a sort of emergency Rennie pouch, which they hung around their neck.
Yeah, it sounded like a lot of food was consumed.
It was a huge amount of food, drink, a lot of rich food, a lot of drink.
2 3-course meals a day, you said.
Something like that, yeah.
That's ridiculous. For a week.
Substantial, yeah, substantial. I actually don't think my brain is not functioning properly since for the last few days. I suddenly need to detox.
You're like some kind of medieval lord over the last week.
Yeah. No, it's good though.
Paris is nice, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It is. Went up the Arc de Triomphe, which I've not done before.
The Arc de Triomphe. Went through that Arc de Triomphe.
Yeah.
Went to the Eiffel Tower. Nice country, France, isn't it?
Paris is, yeah, it's different, isn't it? It's different to London.
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah. I'd be interested to hear more of it. Have you got any material there?
Yeah, sure? I don't have any material, really. It astounds me just to think about how many photos are taken every day in Paris. Mm. I mean, everyone is just taking photos all the time. I mean, I took a few, don't get me wrong.
Yeah. I was going to say, I was following your Instagram.
But it just, I mean, you know, obviously there's a modern condition as well to that. But yeah, I mean, it's just astonishing. No one's doing anything other than taking photos.
Well, yeah, we've talked about it before. Like when you see people going around the Louvre or whatever, and they're just taking pictures of every single piece of art.
When
on the
are
wall.
They going to look at those photos? What are they going to get from the photos?
I genuinely don't understand it. Actually, in Paris, so I went to see the football at Euro 2016 last summer. The guy sat next to me was just videoing the entire game. He had like an actual video camera, which you don't see a lot of anymore, like a Panasonic, whatever. And he videoed the whole game. And occasionally, with his left hand, he got his iPhone out of his pocket and took some pictures. But like, when is he ever, like, do you think at this point, you know, on a Tuesday night, 2 years later, he's just like, oh, you know what? I might sit down and watch the video I took from that Portugal
sure
Iceland game.
You sure he wasn't the analyst? Like the French analyst, isn't it?
He did. He had ITV across his back. It was quite a big camera. Yeah, not really sure.
So one day, someone will give me the answer to this. I mean, you know, we're both guilty of it. We both take photos. You turn up somewhere, you take a photo.
Yeah.
But yeah, some things that people take photos of is just baffling. Like, what are you ever going to get out of that?
I guess it's particularly noticeable in Paris, isn't it? Because it's just so touristy.
Oh, like astonishing.
Yeah,
I mean, maybe I don't know Paris that well. You know, I didn't get out of the areas where the tourists and me were hanging out.
Yeah, well, I do know Paris quite well too, because, as you know, my partner is from Paris, and having spent quite a lot of time there, particularly last summer, it is funny how quite quickly, you know, the kind of novelty of it, or that you stop sort of seeing that like amazing thing that you see when you're first there as a tourist. I mean, it's an incredible city to be in, but when you've walked across those bridges for like the 50th time or whatever, it's not the same. So it is funny when you see all those tourists there and they're taking all those pictures because they just can't believe it and they've never seen this before. I just imagine if you lived there or anywhere that's like, if you lived like near the pyramids or whatever, it's quite an odd concept that you just become so desensitized to this thing that is like the ultimate dream for a lot of people around the world.
Yeah, quite.
Yeah. Well, this is fascinating,
isn't
it?
Yeah, it's good stuff, isn't it? This? It's good stuff.
I was about to say, we have not talked about the World Cup qualifiers tonight because we haven't had time. And now we're just talking about Paris.
Those ramblings.
But yes, unfortunately, we did say we'd talk about the World Cup qualifier, and there's a lot to say about that as well, isn't there? Because, you know, obviously that's been very controversial. We've touched a lot of controversial topics tonight, but been very controversial that, it's only a 10-team World Cup and only two teams came out of that qualifier. Lots to say there, but I think we're going to have to save that for next time because otherwise we're going to go ridiculously long. Well, we're going to be back soon to talk about the second test of the New Zealand series and the World Cup qualifier and all sorts of things besides. But in the meantime, if you enjoy the World Cricket Show, get involved on social media. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter at Cricket Show, we're on Instagram. Write a review for us on iTunes. That's a really great way to help us out, or on whatever podcast platform that you use, because it does bring a lot of people to the show. And if you want to support the show financially, there's a couple of different ways you can do that. You can do it when you're doing your Amazon shopping. Go first of all to cricketshow.net and hit the link there. Or you can make a regular donation at patreon.com/cricketshow. And as we've mentioned a few times before, we are using new equipment that we bought thanks to your support on Patreon. So yeah, many, many thanks to everyone who signed up for that.
I need to go and change the battery in the fire alarm.
Yeah, I don't know if anyone can hear that. Just all the way through, there's been an occasional squeak. About 30 minutes in, I said to Tim, what is that? Oh, it's just the smoke alarm. I think it needs a new battery. It's like, yes, that's exactly what it is.
I did try and unscrew it yesterday. I couldn't get it off, so I need to have another go.
You could get it off, so you went, Oh, well.
Yeah, so literally, that's what I did. I went, oh, leave it.
I'll take care of itself. Or maybe Emily will do it for
you. Yeah, that. Probably.
All right, well, thanks a lot for that, Tane. Stay in school, everyone. And we'll talk to you soon.
Cheers.
Bye-bye for now. I can smell your fear. Ba da da ba ba, ba da da ba ba. Ba da da ba ba, ba da da ba ba. Ba da da ba ba, ba da da ba ba. Ba da da ba ba, ba da da ba ba.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.